I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground in the final show of this season. After we've witnessed genocide in this region through the eyes of scholars, politicians and journalists, could an algorithm help the world out of its moral catastrophe? The mathematical procedure Shor's algorithm promises to aid solutions to geopolitics, hunger, disease, climate change, even if it may leave the door open for a cyber attack on the world's nuclear weapons systems. Naturally, late capitalism is investing in it because elites can harness the algorithm for the parasitical financial services industry to create world-beating investment strategies. Political groups, meanwhile, could use it to break the encryption on global bank transactions. The formula is Shor's algorithm. Its creator is the professor of applied mathematics at MIT, Peter Shor. He joins me now from Cambridge, Massachusetts in the USA. Professor Shor, thanks so much for coming on. Alarming that the entire financial system relying on electronic bank payment transactions, nuclear codes, CIA file encryption, missiles. It might be good, though, for medicine and cures for pandemics and diseases. A lot of stuff is invested in Shor's algorithm, named after you. At its simplest, what is Shor's algorithm?
So Shor's algorithm is a way of factoring large numbers using a quantum computer. So quantum computers are these hypothetical devices, which so far are you only have very preliminary prototypes that show that they will work, but the prototypes are so small they can't actually do anything useful yet. But if they keep on growing the way they have been in the last 20 years, probably in the next 10 or 20 years, they will be able to do useful things. And what Shor's algorithm is actually, it's a way of factoring large numbers,
which needs quantum computers. Now, Russia claims it has a 50-qubit quantum computer by the end of the year. There was a Russian one, 16, at the end of 2023. IBM says they've got a 1,121-qubit, qubit being a unit like binary for your laptop's binary switches inside the inside your laptop. Explain exactly what a quantum computer is, because most people think of their own computers switching on and off, and it's loads of these switches that simulate sums that make graphics and games and all the other things that you do on your computer.
Yeah, so qubit is it's basically a quantum binary switch, which means either it's zero or one. The thing about qubits is that if they have a classical bit, it's either zero or it's one, and there's no in between. For qubits, qubit can be in a superposition of both zero and one at the same time.
So it's got a third option.
Well, it's more than a third option. It's a whole continuum of options. And, at first the thought, you say, well, what's the use of it being in a superposition of zero and one at the same time? What can you do with it? Well, the interesting thing is that there are algorithms you can do using qubits that you cannot do on a classical computer. And one of these is the one I discovered called Shor's algorithm, and it's for factoring large numbers into primes.
Okay, so we may have to go through another stage before we fully get to your algorithm then, because the other day Microsoft was saying it figured out a way of error correction in these quantum computers, because if you're going to get a continuum rather than a discrete zero and a one, the whole point of our laptops is they have systems in there because there's always a mistake going to happen and there's a way of correcting it. I thought the whole point of quantum mechanics, and you might have to explain the two-slit experiment as well, is that when you identify a particle, you change where it's at. So in your quantum computer, when you find out where the switch is, you alter where the switch is.
Yeah, that's right. So when quantum computers first came out, the general consensus was that you would never be able to build these things because they were impossible to correct errors on. And, you know, quantum mechanics is such a delicate theory that there's no way of building a quantum computer that will do gates that are absolutely error-free. I mean, we still think it's true that you can never build a quantum computer with gates that are error-free, but what's different is that we figured out a way of correcting the errors. So quantum mechanics, if you measure something, you change its state. So if you measure the state of a quantum computer in the middle of a computation, the state will collapse, and then the computation will no longer be valid. So how can you measure errors without correcting them? And if you don't measure errors, how can you possibly know whether you have an error and correct it? So the solution to this was to come up with a way of encoding the state of a quantum computer so that you can measure the error without measuring the state that the computer is actually in. And then once you've done that, you know what the error is. You haven't disturbed the computation because you didn't measure the state of the computation. You just measured the state of the error. So now you can correct the error and continue on with the computation.
Isn't the error related to where the state is?
Well, not if you do it right. If you do it right, there's a state of a computation which is protected by the quantum error correcting code. And there are the errors which apply to the qubits, but do not change the state of the quantum computer. Now, if you have a big enough error, so suppose you have an error correcting code, you can have an error correcting code that allow you to correct, say, 5 errors at once. But if you have one of these and you get 7 errors, then that is going to change the state of your quantum computer. But if you have a 5 error correcting code and you only get 5 errors, then you're fine. You correct the errors and keep on with the computation.
Okay, well, back to the algorithm then. We're not advising people who have access to nuclear weapon systems to investigate Shor's algorithm with respect to them. But at the moment, with normal computers, you can't break into the CIA or whatever because of cryptography. Why? What are the reasons why you can't break into a code, say, that Edward Snowden released to the world that we were all being bugged or whatever? He had access to the documents. To break into those documents, you'd have to require the length of the life of the universe or something to be able to break into it. Why is that cryptography so strong, but why is it so weak in the face of your algorithm?
So I guess before around 1975 or so, if you wanted to protect a secret and you wanted to communicate by secret code to somebody else, you needed to have gotten together with the other person and exchanged a secret key. And if you both have the secret key, then one person can encode the message using the secret key and the other person can decode it.
It's what WhatsApp and Telegram and Facebook Messenger and all these social media apps use today, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, but you know, it's really cumbersome and awkward and expensive to exchange secret keys with everyone you're communicating with. So 3 people, I guess Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman, figured out how to exchange messages without using secret keys that both people know. And these are called public key cryptosystems, and they are basically the basis of most communication today. I don't know that whether they're used for protecting nuclear secrets and things like that, but you know, banks,
Why are they so secure, this process?
Okay, so they're so secure because If you suppose you have two prime numbers like 11 and 17, I can take 11 and 17 and multiply them together and get 187. But suppose I give you 187. It's much more complicated to take 187 and factor it and learn it's 11 times 17. Actually, with 187, it's not so complicated. But if you had a 100-digit product of primes, it's much more complicated. And if you have a 300-digit product of primes, the fastest computers in the world don't know how to do it efficiently. So, and what Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman did was they came up with a code so that in order to encode something, you can multiply two prime numbers together and get the product and use that as the basis of the crypto system. But to decrypt the system without knowing the two factors that gave rise to this prime, you need to factor this large number into primes, and that is, you know, basically impossible for computers today. So this is why RSA is used so much. Now, I showed that if you had a quantum computer, you could factor numbers much more efficiently than on a classical computer. So the number of steps on a quantum computer for factoring a large number is essentially not much more than the number of steps it takes to take two numbers together, take two numbers and multiply them together to get this large number. So that means that, you know, if you have quantum computers, RSA, public key cryptography, is no longer secure.
And before anyone thinks that this is just a break into secret codes, even if it is in the public interest, the factoring into primes of big numbers is an important concept in the whole of life on Earth. Even genomes, DNA, proteins, and medicines.
I think you got that a little bit wrong. So factoring large numbers into primes is really not very important in the scheme of things. What is important is that quantum computers can solve quantum mechanics problems very quickly. And you may not think that's important, but when you realize that, you know, chemistry is a quantum mechanical problem, designing drugs is a quantum mechanical problem, building new superconductors that start conducting at larger temperatures than ever before is a quantum mechanical problem. And if you could solve those quantum mechanical problems, you could really make great strides in our knowledge and useful technology and other things.
Professor Peter Shaw, I'll stop you there. More from the award-winning computer scientist and devisor of Shaw's algorithm after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the award-winning computer scientist and devisor of Shaw's algorithm, Professor Peter Shaw. Professor Shaw, we were talking about, or you were correcting me, about the fact that it's quantum mechanics, not so much Shaw's algorithm and the factoring of primes that could solve so many problems in healthcare and who knows what else. Funding on basic science in your country, the United States, is at the lowest for two decades, presumably in favor of weapons funding or something. Is that because policymakers don't understand the potential of quantum mechanics? They don't understand what possibilities quantum mechanics offers, or they're trying to cover it up? No, I'm sure they're not trying to cover it up. Is it very expensive to research?
Actually, quantum computing has a ton of money for it right now. And that, of course, is presumably because it's useful for quantum mechanics. It's also useful for cryptography. What doesn't have a lot of money is the more basic science. So I think they think of quantum computing as applied science, which is actually, it's still pretty far from applied, but it gets classified that way by the policymakers. So if you're trying to, understand the biological pathways and molecules, that might be harder to get funding for. And of course, that is something that could profoundly affect medicine. The policymakers are putting more money into more applied science and less money into the very basic science, which may lead to a deficit of knowledge about basic science, which could be very, and this knowledge could really be useful many years in the future.
Yeah, billions of dollars going into that end of it, not at the beginning end. Just try and explain to the layman like myself why or how one would write a program for a quantum computer, because there are probably coders out there thinking of how you write a little piece of code for a laptop. How do you write the most basic computer program harnessing quantum mechanics in a quantum computer?
Well, it's not so horribly different from writing programs for laptops. So what a quantum computer does is it applies quantum gates, which are really, control pulses.
If this, then that.
Yeah, things like that. So to qubits, and the basic, control pulses are like, control not gates, which say, if this is a one, negate this other bit qubit, and if this is a zero, leave it alone. And things like rotate this qubit by 90 degrees in some basis, and you can rotate things by 90 degrees because qubits are continuous, so they don't just have two options. Rotating it by 180 degrees would be negating it. So rotating it by 90 degrees is the square root of negating it, which is something that doesn't exist on classical computers. So what you need to do is you need to come up with a way of giving these elementary commands that make the computer do what you want to do. And, just like classical computers, you have programming languages which take the sequence of steps that you want the quantum computer to actually do and break them up into elementary gates. And I guess the difference is that there are some constructs in quantum computing which don't exist in classical computing.
You make it sound so simple. Why is it so difficult to construct even a simple quantum computer then? What are they made of, silicon?
Well, there are at least three or four different things they're made of. So one way you can do quantum computing. So for a qubit, you need a two-state system, which is either, say, on or off, or spin up or spin down or something like that. So in ion traps, the basic element is an ion, and you use the electronic state of an ion, and one state is a zero and another state is a one, and you manipulate these states, well, in two ways. One way is by shining lasers on them, and that will change the state of a single ion. And another way is if you have two ions in an ion trap, there's a vibrational mode of the ion trap where all the ions are moving back and forth at once. And what you can do is you can shine a laser tuned to the right frequency that couples your electronic state of the ion to this back and forth motion, and then couples this back and forth motion to a different ion. And that makes the two ions interact. And that gives you a gate between these two ions. these two qubits. So that's ion traps. And, you know, there you have these little silicon chips and you have these little grooves in them. And in the grooves, you arrange electromagnetic fields to hold your ions. And another, another similar method is neutral atoms, where you have very similar to ion traps, but you have neutral atoms, so they are not charged. And again, they're held in traps, and you use lasers to manipulate their quantum states. And there's a completely different method, which is superconducting qubits. And there you have a chip with some superconducting material, I guess, deposited on it. So it's a silicon chip with superconducting material. And the superconducting material, you have little integrated circuit elements called transmons, and a zero, there's a magnetic flux going around clockwise, and a one, there's a magnetic flux going around counterclockwise, and you manipulate these by basically electronics.
Okay, so I mean, it seems relatively comprehensible, yet McKinsey, a very controversial, arguably, consultancy firm, says there'll only be about 5,000 quantum computers by 2030. So why is it going to take so long to get even a basic qubit computer like the one you just described, maybe only 10 switches, maybe you couldn't do much with that, on the market?
Yeah, well, I mean, first, if there's only 10 qubits or only 100 qubits or maybe even only 1,000 qubits, you really cannot do anything with your quantum computer because...
Like a pocket calculator, is it?
Right. Yeah, it's not even as good as a pocket calculator. But because to do, I mean, for a while, we thought that without error correction, you still might be able to do something on a quantum computer. But it's looking more and more like to do anything useful on a quantum computer, you need error correction. And to do error correction on a quantum computer, you need to build... error correcting codes and find fault tolerant operations on them. And the best ones we know about use something like 100 physical qubits for each logical qubit. So suppose you wanted to do a calculation with 1,000 qubits. Well, these would have to be logical qubits, so you'd need 100,000 physical qubits to do it. And I mean, we haven't even gotten 1,000 qubits on a computer yet. So really you need, and to scale up to 100,000, it's probably gonna take at least 10 years and probably longer.
And for Shor's algorithm, it requires one in the tens of millions, I think.
Right, Shor's algorithm, well, Shor's algorithm, actually there's a recent discovery that says you can do Shor's algorithm with fewer than qubits than we thought before. And this is, Oded Regev came up with this, but it still is going to take an enormous number of qubits to even do Regev's inflation of Shor's algorithm.
And as you know, obviously the biggest R&D spender is the Pentagon over there and military, MIT, famously, Noam Chomsky's work there was funded by the military, ironically. Do you think there are dangers that the Pentagon will be using Shor's algorithm together with what Elon Musk has been warning about, profit-driven AI, to create ever more power for tiny elites?
Well, I'd be more worried about the just the AI than Shor's algorithm because it's not clear yet whether, I mean, so a lot of people are studying quantum AI, but it's not at all clear to me that quantum computers do anything to improve AI. And, you know, there's lots of papers written about this, but so far I haven't seen any real convincing demonstrations that quantum computers can improve AI. So it could take a while before this happens.
Just finally, will all these quantum computers be able to help solve theoretical solutions to outstanding mathematical problems that still haven't been solved and have been set, say, 100 years ago?
I think it's possible that maybe one or two of these problems could be solved by a quantum computer, but I think most of them are not going to be amenable to quantum computers, and you just need a very clever mathematician to come along and find a solution.
But will they aid mathematicians in their work?
So the secret, or rather, you know, a little known secret about quantum computers is that for most problems, quantum computers are absolutely no help at all. So you just have to have the right problem to have it solved by a mathematician with a quantum computer. And probably one of these outstanding open problems will be solved this way, but most of them won't.
Professor Peter Shore, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a very interesting conversation.
And that's the final show of this season. We're back very soon, but until then, we'll be broadcasting some of your favorite episodes of the season. You can still keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US-EU armed bombing in Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, and Iraq. We'll see you very soon.